Federal CIOs, like their counterparts in industry, have to deal with systems that start to age almost the moment they go live. That's why so-called legacy systems eventually start to cost a lot in terms of operations and maintenance. I spoke with Mark Schwartz, the CIO of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. He's got 75 systems to oversee and modernize. I asked him, how do you know which ones can be deemed legacy in the first place?
Yeah, it's a tricky term. Let's say that everything becomes legacy as soon as you put it into O&M or you start to think of it as a system you're maintaining. And it's hard not to because the technology keeps developing so quickly that you're always carrying along systems that aren't based on the latest way of doing things. So things become legacy very quickly, I'd say.
And you mentioned that they are mostly in Homeland Security, the parent organization's data centers. Did USCIS have its own data centers, and did you go through a reduction through the initiative to reduce data centers?
We've migrated from about 6 data centers to, I guess it's 3 now, but really most of our stuff is in 1. So we moved into the DHS data center from our various other data centers we had before.
Okay, so that's a good that's 50% fewer data centers, so that's a good consolidation story.
It is, but we're going to take a lot of stuff to the public cloud now, and that's really going to change the game.
And we're going to get into that, but I also wanted to ask you about data holdings. I mean, what's the extent, maybe in terms of terabytes, but also the types that you tend to need for the missions that USCIS has?
A lot. We have a lot of data. We have a lot of paper, too, and I think that's one of the motivations for the transformations we're doing, the modernization efforts. We, as an agency, are really good at managing paper. Over the years, we've had to do a lot of it. Our staff out in the field has become ingenious, you know, at how they can manage to work a paper process. But, of course, now is the time to think electronic and look at cost savings and efficiencies and better customer service by making things electronic. So, really, a lot of what we have is in paper files. These move around the country. They move eventually into a cave where we store our files once we're not using them anymore.
Are these files on people that come, immigrants that come to the United States, or
yes,
people that visit, or immigrants or visitors?
Applicants for our various benefit types. Certain types of applications get saved for the long term, the ones that have to do with immigration. Certain applications are retained for a shorter time. But when you add it all up, there's just a tremendous amount of paper. They say, I don't know where this factoid comes from, but I was told that if you stack up all of the paper that we receive each day, the height of it would be 1.8 times the height of the Statue of Liberty.
That's a lot of paper.
Yes.
that actually gets to be heavy physically to move around. It collapses buildings in some cases.
That I haven't heard about, at least in our agency.
All right. So, and let me ask this as an aside. Is the entry-exit system, is that USCIS or is that a different part of DHS?
That's a different part of DHS, I think. You're probably referring to Customs and Border Protection, CBP.
Okay. So they would have the one where they, I guess their issue has been getting the entry, but it's the exit that's kind of hard.
Ah, yes.
Okay, well,
yes,
it's not
indeed.
You, so we won't go there right now.
Yep.
And all right, let's talk about, before we get to modernizing, let's talk about applications, your application population, because that's an issue for a lot of agencies as they migrate or modernize. They've got sometimes really old applications, even though it might have been recompiled and running on new hardware, it's still old logic.
This is true. We do a lot of upkeep work on those applications. Really, they're the things that run our business and run our business process. And it's a process that's always changing. It could be legislation, or it could be executive action, or it could just be efficiencies and streamlining. And every time our business process changes, and I think this is true of any organization, the IT systems need to change. So
you're almost like the IRS in that respect.
I would assume, yeah.
Basic tax code, but they tinker with it every year, and
absolutely,
that means reprogramming.
Yeah. The Immigration and Nationalities Act, the law that really determines our business process, is a very thick book at this point and very complex. So I would say that the business logic is quite up to date in the sense that we have to keep maintaining it. The technical infrastructure is getting older and older and no longer the way we do things. We, in a way, you could think of our IT systems as falling into a couple of categories, where one category is the systems that help us do our our main business process, which is, you know, receiving applications for immigration benefits, adjudicating those applications, printing proofs of benefit, like green cards, for example. So that's one category of systems. We have another category of systems that's related to E-Verify, which is the program
for employers.
For employers, where we check to see if people are eligible for employment in the country.
And that's somewhat newer than the other ones.
It is, yes. And there's an associated system with it called SAVE. It's really, they share a lot of the same infrastructure. SAVE is to determine eligibility for benefits from benefit granting agencies, government agencies. So those two systems together are another category. And then our third category is all the various support systems, all the miscellaneous things that support our internal operations, things like FOIA processing, Freedom of Information Act. We have we actually receive quite a lot of FOIA inquiries each year. And so we have systems that help our people do redaction on those cases, assemble the information, and send it off to the people who are inquiring.
We're speaking with Mark Schwartz. He is CIO of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services in the Homeland Security Department. And getting back to the business processes, the immigration, the core immigration systems, are those, were they programmed in COBOL or something like that originally, or what's the status?
Most of them are a little bit more up-to-date than that, but not much. And we do have some systems that are COBOL. We have some systems that are on a mainframe. Well, it's hard for me to say because I just got here 5 years ago, but I think the bulk of those systems were really developed in the 1990s, perhaps.
Be C, C-plus types of programming also.
Visual Basic, Visual Basic .NET, and then the various mainframe technologies, IDMS.
So you've got a pretty good maintenance tail to look after there.
Oh, yes.
All right, so that gets us to modernization. What is your goal as you modernize systems? And then we can go talk about some of the strategies that you're using to get there.
Well, for the main benefits processing systems, that first category I mentioned before, we are developing a single system that will manage all of our different benefit types, and that's a pretty big consolidation. We have, last time I calculated, it was about a dozen different systems deal in one way or another with processing those applications. So a single system, we call it Ellis, that...
For like Ellis Island?
It is, yeah. And also for the electronic immigration system. Pretty clever, huh?
That works.
It works.
That's a good coincidence of acronyms.
Yes.
So, names and acronyms.
So Ellis consolidates all of those different functions and... provides a way...
But it's not an island of automation, as they used to say.
It can't be an island in our context, because or at least it would need a lot of bridges. So we've got bridges to about 30 other systems from there.
Okay.
Ellis will also provide the e-filing capabilities so that we can interact with the people who are filing these applications online and provide much better customer service. Much better feedback on the status of their applications, a streamlined application process. We can catch more errors at data entry time, and so on.
So it's not just bundling them all behind one interface. It's also kind of interconnecting them at the back end so that you can be more streamlined and maybe do better data analysis.
Yes. So there's the data analysis, and there's also the adjudication process. So all of that feeds into the system, the part of the system that the adjudicator is used to review the evidence in the case, to review the application. We also bring in information from security checks, background checks, and findings of our part of the organization that deals with fraud and national security issues.
So this integration job, is it an integration job? Is it a recoding? What form does it take technically?
This is building a brand new system.
Okay.
Really, that was the only practical way to do it, because the technology had changed so much in the meantime, and especially moving to the cloud, which we're doing with this, we wanted to build it in a way that was cloud friendly, you know, really take advantage of what the cloud has to offer. So it required really rethinking from the ground up how we do this kind of processing, how we can streamline it, how we should build technically, how we could share code and share logic between the different application types and things like that.
Does that mean you're moving to kind of a unified code base for all of this?
Yes. There's a lot of business logic or process that's specific to each different application type, but there's a lot that's in common also.
So it's
I can give you a good example of that. Scheduling. We have to schedule appointments for biometrics collection for people to come in and give their fingerprints. We have to schedule interviews. We have information appointments where people can come in and ask questions. All of those involve scheduling. And in our legacy systems, we had 8 different scheduling systems for different types of appointments. With transformation, with this Ellis system, we now have a single national appointment scheduling system that handles all of those things and that integrates with the rest of the application process in Ellis.
So is this a matter of capturing the workflows that are happening with the old logic and the old coding and then re-expressing it in new code? Is that the basic process?
It is. There are a lot of decisions we make as we go, whether to automate things that weren't automated before or leave more flexibility and not automate things as they were before. The idea is to optimize the process. So it's very fragile and brittle if you try to automate everything exactly as it is in the rules because things change. And that can often break what you're doing. So we have to make a lot of trade-off decisions, you know, leave flexibility here, take away flexibility there. In general, we want integrity of the data. That's probably the most important thing. So we're adding a lot that that ensures that accurate information is entered, that we can check to see if it's accurate, that we can bounce it against other data sources and correct things wherever we can. Because with legacy systems, you tend to, over time, lose the integrity of the data.
In talking about the modernization process you're going through, it sounds like the proverbial, you know, changing tires on the rolling car or changing the wings on the flying airplane, this kind of thing, is what you're really trying to do because you can't shut down and start up again in 2 years. And so give us a little bit of the philosophical approach to how you do this.
Yeah, it's something I love to talk about, actually. This is where I get on my soapbox a little bit. Modernization projects are tricky, and it's easy to go wrong on them, I think. It's easy to turn them into high-risk efforts. And the way that we often do that in the IT world, in the government world, is we think of modernization as taking an old system and replacing it with a new system. The problem with that is that you can't release the new system until you've at least matched the capabilities of the old system. People won't use it, right? You can't actually ask people to use it because they were better off in the old system. So as a result, we often or traditionally do a long project to try to completely replace the system. And that means we're not releasing code, we're not releasing product to people for this long period of time until the new system is ready. And that increases our risk dramatically. Much better is if we can take little pieces, have people start using them, and then incrementally add to them, which is really the agile way of doing things. That's really best practice these days. So the way we prefer to do it is to use what we call a strangulation pattern, where we take the old system, we break off a little piece of it, and we modernize that little piece, and we get people to start using that piece, and then we break off another piece and get people to start using that, and just keep doing that until the old system is completely gone.
Kind of like George Washington's hatchet. First you change the wedge, then you change the handle, then you change the blade, but otherwise it's the same hatchet.
In fact, there's a long history of this question in philosophy, and I sometimes have talked about this. There's the old ship of Theseus paradox from ancient Greece. There's the Sorites paradox. They're all the same. It's the question of, is something the same if you change every piece of it over the course of time? And that's exactly what I'm suggesting here, is that we modernize the system by breaking it into pieces, doing a little piece at a time in a low-risk way, but keeping the old system operating at the same time.
And so this brings the cloud into the equation for you in a very important way.
The cloud is the big enabler of this, yes. With the cloud, what we can do is create infrastructure for the system as we need it. So as we break off each piece, we can just almost magically create the infrastructure, the servers, the network, the environment that we need in the cloud for that piece. And then as we break off the next piece, do the same thing over and over again. And we only pay for what we're actually using. So as we add pieces, we pay more and more, but we don't have to get capacity for the entire system in advance. And if a modernization program is going to last 3 or 4 years, as it often does in the government, if you buy the hardware at the beginning, it's going to be out of date by the time you finish. This way, we never run that risk. We're constantly reprovisioning the hardware in the cloud.
And earlier you said that you want to make sure that new applications are cloud friendly. So this is almost an automatic way of ensuring that, because that's where they start out life.
That's where they start out, and we build them the right way from the beginning. There's something called a sort of series of best practices called cloud friendly applications, or the 12-factor applications. There are 12 characteristics that if you incorporate those characteristics into your new system, it will work well in the cloud and be flexible. You can move it to different clouds. And as long as you have a cloud available, you know it's going to work. So we try to build that way.
And how do you get these built? Do you use systems integrators to do the coding? Do you have your own people do it? How do you actually effectuate the new code?
We use contractors, but we have a process that we've honed over the last few years that's rather different from the way we've traditionally done things. For the transformation program for building Ellis, we set up a contract structure where we have a lot of contractors involved doing different pieces of the puzzle, and the government functions as the systems integrator. More importantly, the government controls what's being built at all times. So the government is working together with the contractor. There's really a lot of face-to-face interaction. Government people serve as product owners. They prioritize the requirements. They frame the requirements for the contractor, and they do it just in time. As the contractor is starting work, the government person working with them will explain what's needed with the latest up-to-date information about what's needed, and then give feedback to the contractor as they develop stuff, and then ultimately approve or disapprove of the functionality. And it's really built that way, one function at a time, one little piece of functionality.
And so the
at a
users
time.
Are part of this also.
Users are part of it. Usually the government product owner represents the users. Often they are people who usually do this job, but who've been empowered to manage the vision of the product. But we also have everyday users giving feedback on the product as we go, and testing, and making sure it's going to work for them in the field. That's a very important part of it.
We're speaking with Mark Schwartz. He is CIO of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services in the Homeland Security Department. And those are also agile elements.
That's a classic agile development process, yeah. And so in an agile approach to delivering systems, what we do is put in a lot of short feedback loops, as we like to call it. So as soon as somebody does some work, somebody comes and gives feedback, and you get the feedback very quickly, adjust what's been done, and that way you get very quickly to a finished product, and it saves a lot of money. It's a known piece of economics of software development that if there's a problem with your software and you don't catch it until late in the process, it's much more expensive to fix it than if you catch it quickly in the process. So we always try to have short feedback loops with people who are actually going to be using the software, because ultimately they're the ones who it has to work for.
And who is the person, or is there a committee that declares a given component or system now operational and the system of record?
We are moving to what's a very recent best practice, something called DevOps or continuous delivery. Those are two related ideas, where we are trying to put new functions in production, put them out to actual users constantly. So in the old world, where we might have released software once every 18 months or something, now we actually release software every day in some cases, sometimes even multiple times per day. And we release it in a turned off state, you know, so we actually put it into the product with a little switch in it that says
don't. It's compiled by that point.
It's compiled. It's fully tested. It's available, except that we've turned it off so nobody can use it. And then at the appropriate moment, we turn it on. when we know that the appropriate training has taken place, when the business is ready, you know, when whatever organizational change management that we need has happened. But we do try to make that as quick as possible. You know, we can add tiny features for people without doing a lot of retraining. So we try to take these small increments and actually make them available to people very quickly.
Now let's talk about the cybersecurity strategy here, too, because the common phrase is we've got to build cybersecurity into applications and networks instead of adding it on later. It sounds like you've got a great opportunity to make sure systems are cyber secure from the outset. How do you do that?
Yeah, and that's the only way we can do what I just said. If you think about the idea that we're going to deploy new features to production multiple times per day, that means we can't have a long cybersecurity testing process after we finish each feature. It just wouldn't work if that was what we did. So we take a very different approach. We build the security in from the beginning. We have security people working together with the developers, and we test it right away at the beginning to make sure the basic framework is secure. And then we regression test it every day. Regression test means make sure that you haven't added something that breaks something that was already there. So essentially what we're doing is we're starting with a hardened system, with a secure system, and then constantly retesting it to make sure it's still hardened or still secure. That way we know that when we deploy something new to production, it's going to be safe. We can always rely on it.
Because I imagine that the data that USCIS has is highly sought after by a lot of bad people all over the world, given the number of people that have come into the country legally, illegally, whatever. You've got information on most of them. And that, I can't imagine how valuable that would be to various parties.
That's true. Where there's the classic three elements of security that we worry about: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Those are the classic three that security is focused on. All three are very important to us in what we do. Confidentiality is important because we have very sensitive information on people who are applying. And in some cases, maybe their home government would love to know that information. There are all sorts of bad guys that would love to know that. Integrity is important because we don't want false information coming into the system or information changing once it's in the system that could cause us, for example, to grant a benefit to a bad guy, you know, let him into the country. So integrity is really important to us. Availability is really important because we have to process 7 million applications a year for one thing or another. And if our systems were not available, then the whole immigration system presumably would come to a grinding halt, as would a lot of our sister agencies. You know, CBP at the border would be stuck, and ICE and their detention and removal would be stuck. So all three of those are very important to us, and we act in that way. We act as if we're always under assault. We're always facing advanced persistent threats. And part of it is hygiene, you know, just making sure that we've done all the right things that are basic security. Part of it is also proactively trying to figure out what the bad guys might try to do and then testing to make sure that they can't do those things.
And a final question, what is your shared services strategy? You can't really talk about enterprise IT without shared services in this day and age.
Well, one thing that's shared, of course, is the public cloud in a funny sense of the term. And it has a lot of the advantage of traditional shared services because Amazon or Microsoft, whoever the cloud provider is able to invest on behalf of all their clients and take advantage of economies of scale and so on. So we get very good service that way. But one area that I'm really interested in now, and we're starting to do a little bit of experimenting around it, is the idea of sharing or reusing code across different government agencies. So, or even within our own agency, because traditionally projects are done in silos and they don't necessarily talk to each other or share code. So we've taken some of the ideas of open source systems, like GitHub is a very popular platform on the web where people can work on code together and share open source code. So we have our own internal version of GitHub, and we're putting all of our code in it and building communities around it so our different projects can share that code. But then we're going to also look to see if we can use that as a way to share code across DHS and then ultimately across the whole federal government. So this is pie in the sky. We haven't actually done it yet, but I think we have a good path to getting there, and we're going to be trying over the next couple of years.